Welcome back to Detroit Rising. This is Chad Livengood, senior editor at Crane's Detroit Business. This month marks 5 years since Detroit exited bankruptcy. It seems like almost a lifetime ago, Detroit was going through a very painstaking bankruptcy, shedding multiple billions of dollars of legacy debt to get the city to a better place and be more financially healthy. And to talk about that this week, my guest is Dave Mazeron. He is the chief financial officer for Mayor Mike Duggan's administration. And Dave, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Chad. It's good to be here.
Also joining us on the podcast this week is Crane's reporter Annalise Frank to talk to help me interview Dave, and we're going to pin him down on some real tough questions. Thanks for joining, Annalise.
Good to be here, Chad. Thank you.
Dave, let's start by give us a little bit of an overview. When you entered the administration early 2014, obviously the mayor was sharing power with the emergency manager still. What did the city government, the functions of city government, look like at that stage in the middle of the bankruptcy?
Well, Chad, that it seems like a lifetime ago, but really at that point, all of the functions of city government were chaotic. There had been such a lengthy disinvestment in our workforce, in our capital, and all of the things that enable the city to do its job. Really, a number of things weren't functioning, whether it be the lighting system, our bus system. Nothing really was functioning at the level it should, and everything needed to be redesigned so that city government would function. So really, in the beginning, it was very chaotic as we tried to get the necessary equipment, tools, and people into position to carry out the functions of the city.
One of the main goals of the bankruptcy was to relieve the city of debt, to free up money basically for just basic operations, because at the outset of the bankruptcy, something like every $10 was going to some type of legacy cost, whether it was operating debt or pensions or retirement. What's that number look like today in the city's health?
So the number is much lower today, and part of that is there's a 10-year holiday the city enjoys in large part from pension payments. I think we project in the future it's going to go up anywhere between 11 and 25%, the relatively near future. But that is much more in line with our peer cities and with functioning governments than where we were headed. I mean, I think if the growth in our pension and other kind of obligations and long-term obligations of the city had continued unabated without the bankruptcy, it would subsume basically the entire city budget as we get into 24 and 25. It would have been completely impossible to operate going forward. And when you think about that, you know, bankruptcy was about a balance sheet issue, but it really wasn't the balance sheet that drove why we went bankrupt. What drove why we went bankrupt was we had achieved what I'd call a servant's insolvency, which is that the people who lived and worked here were getting such poor services they were leaving. And what happens when you hit that servant's insolvency level is more and more of your tax base erodes, and you can deliver less and less services, and you're never able to get to a point as a city where you can provide services where people want to live and work. And until you get out of that cycle, there's really no escaping kind of a continual decline. And the bankruptcy was really about trying to find a way to deliver services to the people who live and work here.
So how did the bankruptcy free up money? What was the real, at the time they talked about, I think it was like $1.5 billion would be freed up over 10 years for investment. How has that shaked out? We can see there's been obviously a lot of services that have changed dramatically. You no longer have to wait an hour for an ambulance to come pick you up, to take you to the hospital in this city. But how is that changed? And I know the mayor, your boss, is very much focused on a lot of data. And maybe you can talk a little bit about those meetings you have where he's asking about how the data is doing.
Yeah. So those are sometimes my favorite and least favorite days of the week. They're Wednesday mornings where we all have to report on how we're doing operationally towards the mayor's long-term goals. And as you mentioned, I joined the city in a different role, and in the role during the period in which we were improving services. One of the things I was responsible for, example, is DDOT. And DDOT had gotten to the point where we were pulling out 65% to 70% of the buses. Our on-time percentages were in the 50%. It really wasn't a service that you could rely on without getting there an hour or two early, because you didn't know if the bus was going to show up. So there, the bankruptcy enabled us, coupled with some federal support, to order upwards of 180 new buses. We were actually able, through investments in management and the restructuring both of the internal finance operations and grant operations, to deploy 2,000 more weekly trips, and we haven't increased our budget on an operating basis. But freeing up capital and then also freeing up and developing the Office of Grants to monitor how those grants are spent and to deploy them as efficiently as possible has enabled us to dramatically improve services there, to the point where we're at the national average of on-time bus arrival. And the point I guess I'm trying to make here is it's not just the ability to invest that $1.5 billion. That was an important outcome of bankruptcy. It was also the ability to restructure our finance operations, to develop a grants office that a couple days ago announced that it had raised more than $1 billion since its inception and has dramatically reduced the number of findings under the leadership of Ryan Fredericks and Carole Bonds and Serene. Those types of restructurings have been a big part of us moving forward. As to the $1.5 billion, I'll just take a second to say we have been able to invest numbers equal to what the plan of adjustment had anticipated, but we've had to find other sources. And we've had to find other sources because immediately after the bankruptcy, we realized that we had a pension funding problem where the projected 2024 payment in the plan of adjustment is about $111. And right now we projected at $164 million. So we knew we had a $50 million delta that was in the future that we were going to have to meet. And candidly, we anticipate that number is going to be higher.
Let's just break that down a little bit. Okay. Cut a little of the CFO talk out of it.
You had
basically a $50 million shortfall from what the bankruptcy consultants hired by the emergency manager were projecting. They had a more rosy projection.
I hesitate to call it a more rosy projection because it deals with mortuary tables or when we project retirees would die. So they were more pessimistic about that, which leads to a more rosy financial picture, because ultimately your pension obligation pays until there's no one to pay the benefit to. When those tables were updated, we discovered we had on an annual basis that $50 million shortfall. And keep in mind, we are going to go from $0 in pension funding under the plan of adjustment to $110. When you add another $50, that is a really difficult thing for a city to plan for.
So your predecessor, John Hill, developed essentially a fund to try to make this road a little easier to climb. Can you talk a little bit about what was set up, the pension trust fund, and how it's going to work, or how it's supposed to work once that due date comes in 2024.
This is something that I think as an administration is one of the things we're most proud of. There are very few cities in the country and maybe the world that are planning for obligations that come due in 10 years. And what John Hill designed, and that was passed by city council and approved by the mayor, is what we call the Retiree Protection Fund. But it effectively is an account where we deposit and plan to deposit $335 million over that 10-year plan, which wasn't in the plan of adjustment, but is really our decision as a budgeting mechanism to make us more able to or put us in a better position to meet that future pension obligation.
How is the city now kind of moving forward? What do our revenue streams look like? I mean, you can tell from all the job growth in the city that people are paying more income tax. But if there were a big layoff of let's say mortgage bankers at a certain company down the street here, if in a housing downturn, how would the city be prepared to sustain the loss of income tax revenue from such a type a layoff or recession going forward.
So, Chad, you're bringing up a good point, which is, you know, what is our preparedness for a recession? We modeled out in last year's budget what various levels of recession would do to our budget. You know, whether it's a 2001 internet.com kind of moderate recession, or the more cataclysmic recession that the city faced later in the 2000s, in that decade, in the early part of 2010 and 11, before the city and the economy started to recover. And it's a pretty healthy hit to our balance sheet. One of the things we've tried to do that Moody's recognized is continue to build our reserves so that we're able to sustain operations and make changes to our operations gradually. At the end of the day, if you have a recession, they have a tendency to come on quick, and to cut costs takes time because you have to plan that out in a way that ensures that citizens still get the services they need. So we are getting more and more prepared. In this coming budget, we will be setting aside more in reserve. We have created with City Council a fiscal sustainability working group where we're trying to plan out where we could cut that would have as little impact as possible on our baseline services, so that when the day comes, because we always assume at some point an economic contraction is in the future, we'll be prepared to meet it. We've also paid down long-term debt in a way to give us more breathing room as we get to those years where our budget gets tighter.
And isn't it also true that is around 2026 expenditures are supposed to start exceeding revenues? I imagine that adds an additional layer of challenge. How else is that being prepared for, adapted to?
That is a tremendous challenge. You know, one of the things that we did, and we issued our first 10-year fiscal long-term outlook report this year, is we try to calculate out if we give all the services that we give today going forward, and we assume the labor cost increase and CPI increase on goods and goods that we buy, what that will look like when we compare it to how we project revenues to go. And you're completely right. In 2026, we begin to cross the line where our expenditures increase our revenues or exceed our revenues. If you looked prior to the work we've done over the last 5 years, that number was much bigger and much more difficult to deal with. So we have made progress in cooperation and partnership with City Council towards doing that. And we're going to have to identify efficiencies where we can do what we do today more efficiently. And we're also going to have to continue to have economic growth to grow our tax base. And I think every year we've been able to meet or exceed those targets, and we are hopeful we'll be able to continue to do it. Of course, an economic contraction would change that, and that means in 2026, the level of services that residents get, we have to find a way to maintain at a baseline, but we may very well have to make cuts.
Well, we're 13 minutes into this podcast, and if anybody's still listening, we're going to start talking about the Headley Amendment here in a second. So if you need to tune out, go ahead. But for those who want, the geeks that want to stay on, listen, you talk about growing the tax base. There is an inherent issue with the constitution of the state in capping that growth. And at the same time, the city has been granting a healthy stream of tax abatements to get people to bring jobs and economic development to the city. Ford in Corktown, Fiat Chrysler's automobiles plant in on the east side on Mac, and any number of projects in the greater downtown. Is that going to catch up to us at some point in this next decade, where we've abated a whole bunch of the tax growth and there's not a lot of room to actually make up for those losses?
Well, tax abatements have existed in the city for decades. The way we try to look at it is each time there's a tax abatement that's offered, my office in the budget group does a analysis on whether or not there's a positive return on investment, and we make the decision at the level of abatement based on that analysis. But you're absolutely right. Because of the way the Headley Amendment works, the city's property taxes is a very small portion of our general fund, say $118 million of about a $1 billion fund. And that property tax for other governments is a very stable revenue source. And we rely in large part on income taxes, which is much less stable. So for Chrysler to come, there's a number of abatements they get on property taxes. The people who work there will be paying income tax, and that will be a great revenue boost when it occurs. But of course, if the economy turns, Chrysler or FCA doesn't need to keep those employees employed, and we'll have a bigger revenue hit. And we don't have the stabilization force of a property tax. That's inherent in the way Michigan has structured local government, and it's what we have to deal with.
You get 5,000 new employees working, you know, at $25 an hour or something. What does that come out to? Well, I guess it's hard to tell because some of them might be residents, right, and some of them might be non-residents. But the income tax is sizable enough to make up for the loss of the property tax?
Yeah, I don't have the return on investment sheet in front of me, but the city and state put a considerable amount of subsidy into that transaction, whether it be sure. certain abatements on taxes or property that relates to FCA. But at the end of the day, each of those employees will be paying income tax. And through our analysis, based on what FCA committed to do in the relevant development agreements, the city comes out ahead. And, you know, there's two components of this, too, that when you look at it from a return on investment. The other thing that was negotiated into the agreement by the mayor was that Detroiters have a first opportunity to apply for those jobs. And DESC has done an amazing job of getting people into that queue. And if we can provide opportunity for our residents, that A, attracts more residents, but probably more importantly, allows our existing residents to have an advantage and an opportunity to compete for what is a really good job.
What's the thinking on suppliers for the FCA expansion? I mean, DEGC has been trying to assemble land, right? And you know, is that going to be a considerable source of income taxes? You know, and there's also, you know, the cost to consider of, you know, identifying sites and preparing sites for industrial use. What, you know, is that going to be something that the city can afford? What's the thinking there?
So I guess there's a couple things here. One is obviously we have a new economic development director who probably can more aptly speak on the supplier strategy. But I will say that the mayor and therefore our budget that have been proposed to council and approved by council have funded a good deal of support for the assembly of land. FCA and every auto plant has the ability, the tremendous side benefit of bringing a number of suppliers to the area. And we've had some success in landing them, which have been widely reported on by Cranes. But one of the things that is vital to the city being able to compete for those jobs is the ability to assemble land. And the city needs to pay money to either clean environmental degradation that was left behind by old industrial operators, or where we have control of parcels, purchase and acquire parcels around so that we have a sizable enough area for a supplier to locate. This will be something that the city and something that the city has worked on for many years. If you remember back when that Chrysler plant was originally built, Mayor Young used condemnation as a way of acquiring land. That's no longer available to the city. You can't use condemnation to do economic development. So what the city needs to do is a forward-looking investment of understanding where we have land assets and over time how we can build, you know, 30, 40-acre parcels where suppliers can locate.
This is why you had to pay, like, the Maroon family tens of millions of dollars in cash and land to get an 80-acre parcel for FCA this year.
Yeah, it's why we had to do a number of transactions that if 5,000 jobs weren't on the line, the city wouldn't have done. At the end of the day, you know, we had to make a decision based on 5,000 jobs versus those jobs not coming. And candidly, I mean, this investment by FCA in the existing plant means those jobs that are there now are more likely to stay for the long term. So ultimately, you know, the mayor made a decision to negotiate a number of transactions that Tom Lawan negotiated that resulted in us paying out a lot of money for land assembly, but it was really the only way we could assemble land at a size and scope necessary for FCA to locate here.
Mayor Duggan has had quite a lot of success with this city council. If people think back 10 years ago, that was not the case for some of his predecessors who had, you know, infamous battles with city council. But he lost one recently with this blight bond proposal. Can you talk a little bit about that and what's the next step going forward without getting council's approval to put the $250 million bond on the ballot in March?
Well, at the end of the day, it's incumbent upon us as an administration to answer council's concerns. And, you know, candidly, we didn't do that, and it was reflected in the vote. So what we need to do is get to work on restructuring and reforming both the way the land bank manages the disposition of property and also the demo operations so that council has confidence that they're done in a way that meets their priorities going forward. In working with them, we made a number of commitments to do those things. And ultimately, what I believe was indicated to us by council is they wanted to see us implement those reforms before they approved putting the ballot, putting the measure on the ballot. And it's incumbent upon us to find a way to satisfy their concerns to get it back on the ballot so that we can continue the program. Without that funding, you know, ultimately the speed at which the city is able to procure demolition services will drop.
There was a thought raised by Council President Brenda Jones at one of the council meetings in November where she suggested, you know, essentially in order to kind of prove that, you know, this is something that will be done transparently, you know, she suggested some sort of pilot program to you know, implement this new strategy for demolition. Is that something that is being considered at all?
So the answer is, you know, we'll consider anything that council would like us to consider. But I think ultimately we end up in a position where we are doing a pilot program because the city is going to have to operate with its general fund to demo over the next period of months until something ends up on the ballot. Right now we've expended all of the funds we have for what I'll call discretionary demolitions, meaning non-emergency or non-pockets of demolition that relate to some public other kind of program.
This is the federal funding.
Yeah, the federal funding and the city funding. We've already expended it for the fiscal year and because the procurement process is so lengthy for demolition. So there's been a number of reforms that had already been put in place. Part of our process over the next several months will be to show council what we have put in place, and then part of it will be to develop a demolition department, which we committed to do to bring that service inside the city. You know, one of the concerns council had and that has been raised by a number of different people is the kind of clunky manner in which demolitions were done. And a lot of that was driven by the federal funding requirements that it be an outside entity doing the procurement. So we think when we bring this back in, we'll be able to answer a lot of those concerns. And of course, you know, the disposition policy at the land bank has always been a subject of controversy. And that's something that Mr. Jameson and Saskia over at the land bank are going to have to work with council to come to an agreement as to what that looks like.
Because we're ultimately, you've had a lot of controversies with that program, and it's kind of gotten a little muddled together, and you're trying to sort that out. At the end of the day, I'm hearing you correctly, you have now basically expended all the money that's left. Are we going to see basically demolition grind to a halt here this winter?
So no, I mean I think you're going to see demolition start to slow down. There. The HHF funding or the federal funding will continue. I think the demolitions for that will go through about March. And then the city demolitions will be about the same period. But at that point, it will dramatically slow down because the federal funding's gone. The last time we had expended all the federal funding or were kind of saw that mark on the horizon, we were able to go to President Obama's administration and get a sizable additional set of funding. You know, we just don't anticipate that Washington is going to provide that help to us. So we need to figure out a way to do that on our own. Ultimately, I think and I got to stop using the word ultimately, but all of the council members believe that demolition is an important part of the strategy going forward to help stabilize and revitalize neighborhoods. We just have to find the right mix of oversight and programmatic change to make them comfortable. And I'm confident that with enough time and work, we'll be able to do that.
I think
thoughts here, yeah.
I think, you know, kind of listening to council during these sort of deliberations over the you know, $250 million blight bonding proposal, an underlying theme there was transparency. And you know, I think it was kind of, you know, council discussed the sort of issues with Make Your Date and the report that came out at one of those same sessions. And the council president, you know, discuss the issue of transparency in relation to that and the blight program. Is there, you know, do you have thoughts on how the, you know, administration may be, you know, seeking to, you know, combat those concerns? Or
yeah, I think there's a few different things that kind of rose to the top there, and ultimately, it's going to be on us to establish and build trust around this program. You know, right now, if you go online, you can see every demolition the city's done. You can see the price for that demolition. And what we've tried to do is to build more and more ways that people have transparent looks to the information that we have. So, you know, if you look on the website now, you can see we have an online checkbook where you can see every vendor payment and map through to the contract. The theory being at the end of the day, if we're able to provide transparency and let people see every activity, good, bad, or indifferent of the city, that helps to build trust and reestablish trust with council. And that's something we need to work on. The demo program in particular, people forget you have 19,000 different activities by a contractor that we've managed to do so far. And every time a contractor does something, and we all know this from doing kitchen remodels or bathroom remodels, contractors often will cut a corner or make a mistake, and people need to monitor it. And the city has learned a tremendous amount. And going forward, I think the program will continue to get better under the leadership of the administration and the operations groups. But I think there will always be, and there always has been, controversy around a program like this because it will never be perfect. And what we need to do on the front end is acknowledge that we're doing everything we can to mitigate the risks of mistake. And then when the mistake occurs, we're transparent about it and figure out how to fix it.
Ultimately, at the outset of the bankruptcy, none of these programs even existed. I mean, none of this work was being done. You know, a city that was essentially, you know, dysfunctional on several, you know, service fronts. And so a lot has changed in the 5 years since the city emerged from bankruptcy.
Yeah, and a lot has changed, and we do a lot more. And what is so great about this job and this city and the people who live here is they always raise their expectations as we improve. So every day it's a new challenge that we have to figure out how to meet, and every day we're going to struggle and work to meet that challenge. I really do have confidence that the city can weather the next recession, and the reason I have confidence is the mayor and city council have always been aligned around fiscal prudence and fiscal stability in making budgeting decisions, and I have no reason to believe that's going to shift. That obviously is the key to us moving forward. And I will also say the other key to us moving forward has been the alignment with the philanthropic and business community. Everybody pulling in the same direction around the same set of policies has enabled us to do so much more quickly than we thought we could.
Dave Mazeron, Chief Financial Officer for the City of Detroit, Mayor Mike Duggan, thank you for joining us here on the Detroit Rising Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Chad. It was a lot of fun.
I'm Chad Livingood, Senior Editor at Crain's Detroit Business, alongside Annalise Frank from Crain's. Thank you for joining us and listening to this week's segment. If you're listening to our podcast on SoundTunes, please subscribe to our iTunes page or wherever else you get your podcasts.